final interview for this program was with Dr. Atif Hussain, a general medical oncologist from Hollywood, Florida. And to begin, we talked about a 51-year-old woman with stage 3 adenocarcinoma of the ovary from his practice.
This is a wonderful 51-year-old woman whom I saw in 2008, I think. At that time, she presented with typical symptoms of ovarian cancer with some bloating, and she had debulking surgery, serous stage 3 adenocarcinoma of the ovary. She had optimal debulking, and she recovered from the surgery well. After that, we actually gave her chemotherapy with both intraperitoneal and intravenous chemotherapy, and amazingly, she did very well. She tolerated the treatment well for 6 cycles, and her CA125 became normal after the second cycle. Unfortunately, a year and a half after that, she recurred. At that time, she was treated with carboplatin and paclitaxel for 6 cycles. She went again into complete remission. And after that, by 9 months, she recurred. She received several regimens of therapy. At one point, she was given bevacizumab, and unfortunately, she developed acute renal failure, severe hypertension, a proteinuria, which is really unusual to have renal failure from bevacizumab. I think the hypertension was not very well controlled, but once we controlled hypertension, the patient's creatinine renal function improved, but she would not take bevacizumab again. She received several lines of treatment. Unfortunately, after the last regimen of topotecan, she opted for palliative care, and unfortunately, she died at home with hospice care.
So maybe we can focus a little bit on what happened when she got the bevacizumab.
Yeah. When she started, she had some borderline hypertension, Neil. She was not on any antihypertensive agents. Within, I think, either the second or the third dose of 15 milligram per kilo every 3 weeks, we definitely documented that her diastolic blood pressure was reaching 85-90. At that time, I started her on ACE inhibitor. That was controlled, but the blood pressure kept on going up. I sent her to see a nephrologist who started taking care of the blood pressure. He added to the ACE inhibitor a calcium channel blocker, but all of a sudden, her creatinine started going up, and it reached 4. She never needed acute dialysis, but of course, we stopped the bevacizumab, and as I said, over a period like 3-4 months, her creatinine and blood pressure, they went back under control once we stopped bevacizumab, and that scared her a lot.
Did she have proteinuria at that time?
Yes, she had a proteinuria. She had around 3 grams of protein in 24 hours.
And what was going on with her disease during this time?
It's interesting to ask. She was responding very well. Her CA125 was around 800. And actually, with only 5 or 6 doses of bevacizumab, it went down to around 40. Therefore, she actually had a drastic improvement. But I couldn't convince her to restart on the medication. She really was very, very worried at that time.
And what was the status of her disease? Did she have ascites? Where did she have the disease at that point?
She did not have ascites. She had a lot of peritoneal disease causing pain, but she actually had very little ascites.
And actually, as I look at her clinical course, that was the first time as fourth-line therapy that she'd gotten bevacizumab. She'd previously gotten pegylated liposomal doxorubicin, but without the Bev. We saw a lot of people in our survey who got both in combination, you know, as sort of the first platinum-resistant doublet. How do you sort of select what to do in that situation?
Yeah, this is a very good question. It really depends on discussing it with the patient. I usually try not to use them together, not that there is safety issues, but I worry about cardiac coronary issues. And if I want to use bevacizumab with something else, I would tend to use it with other chemotherapeutic agents, such as nab-paclitaxel or platinum, if they are still sensitive. But I usually use single agent. I go with single agent, especially in patients who is not very symptomatic, and I don't want to make them sicker than they are.
So anything you'd like to see Dr. Beer address in this case, particularly about this episode with the bevacizumab?
Yeah, I mean, this really makes me wonder, like many, many people, it's like, is there a real surrogate marker for response to bevacizumab? And the dose, 15 milligram per kilo, could I have restarted her with a smaller dose? Do we know? what's the minimum biologically effective dose of bevacizumab, how often to give it, how better to control the hypertension and the proteinuria in these patients. If somebody develops nephrotic syndrome range of proteinuria and the patient agrees to restart once it subsides, would you restart it knowing it could recur? Again, really, the most important thing to me with bevacizumab is a marker of response. Who will respond better? Who wouldn't respond so that we can use it in the right patient?
You know, in listening to this case, the one thing that at least jumps out to me is the creatinine going up. What did your nephrologist say? Was she volume depleted? What was going on?
He thought very strongly it's really the hypertension. It's like acute hypertension. This is a patient that was not really hypertensive. And I mean, her blood pressure went up. We documented systolic above 200 and diastolic above 140 millimeter of mercury.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, she was really asymptomatic, but very, very hypertensive, which is really unusual. I mean, we use bevacizumab for more than a decade and they have in so many cancers. Usually you don't get this acute event. I was worried, is the patient gonna develop hemolytic uremic syndrome, sort of? But she never had any hemolysis to suggest it.
So, you know, you talked about markers of response, and, you know, one that I've heard debated has been actually the development of hypertension. So you said she responded really well, and you also said she had this real sensitive situation in terms of hypertension. Maybe they're correlated. We should ask Dr. Barrow that.
Oh, absolutely. I would really appreciate it if he can respond to that, not necessarily with real data, but from his own personal experience. Has he seen that? Has he looked at the patient he treated? Because I think we really need to come up with a predictive and a surrogate marker for bevacizumab. Not everybody responds, but those who respond, they respond beautifully in advanced ovarian cancer.
So, you know, we asked a bunch of psychosocial questions of the docs who took this survey. And one of the things we asked was, did the patient have any short-term goals that they were able to fulfill? Now, this lady actually survived quite a few years with advanced ovarian cancer, so she did better than usual. What did she achieve during that time period that you were able to observe?
Yeah, she was really an amazing woman. She was so focused on her life, her daughter. She has two children, a daughter and a son. Her daughter got married. She has two grandchildren. But amazing, we talk about the psychosocial and the positive attitude. This lady was the poster child of positive attitude. She never worried about a number. We would check her CA125 and she would look at it and she say, no, I am not ready. I don't have symptoms. I know the data. I read. She really lived her life. She wanted to live. And she actually was dealing with another disease. I don't know if I mentioned it in the case. She had actually bad psoriasis with arthritis, but was very well controlled. I would have thought when I was giving her chemotherapy, Neil, that she would do well. She actually did not. Every now and then I would have to give her weekly methotrexate because of pain in her joints from psoriasis. I don't know if there is any correlation between the toxicity with bevacizumab and psoriasis. She was not on methotrexate when she developed the complications from bevacizumab.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing, but what about NSAIDs?
She was not really taking many. I was giving her tramadol every now and then, but she knew. No, she was not. She was very, very aware of it because of methotrexate.
And another thing I thought was interesting, you know, we asked the physicians also, in this particular case, and of course all these cases, the patient died from advanced cancer, to what extent did you feel attached to the patient? It's not easy to get attached to somebody in that situation. And you described this patient, you checked off very attached.
Very, very attached. Let me tell you, this is a lady that I see her talking to you. I see her voice. I see her daughter. You know, her husband will come every now and then, but wasn't really very involved. Not because he didn't care. They were a very loving family. He just couldn't handle it. Yeah, this is a lady who we actually have in our healthcare. If a patient will, you know, donate money for the foundation, and she was very, very active, and it was a pleasure and honor and a privilege to take care of her. She was amazing. She really was. She lived her life, and her daughter visited us several times after she died.
You know, a lot of people are not in the field, or maybe people coming in the field like fellows might find it interesting to see so many docs, quote, emotionally attached to patients. You look like you're a pretty happy, content person. How do you make that happen?
Yeah, experience definitely teaches that. I mean, medicine in general, but oncology, Neil, is a privileged subspecialty we do. I really, really believe that. I teach my patients correct, but they teach me a lot. And they taught me a few years into this how to establish a very good balance between, you know, work and life and family and everything else. It is a very, very humbling experience to see these patients going through it. When you compare what you go through every day to what they go through, I mean, you will be ashamed to complain. And honestly, I think this is a very important teaching point to me, looking these people into the eye and sitting with them. Like, you know, Neil, giving chemotherapy and ordering stuff. I mean, we click a couple of buttons in our electronic medical record. You have the regimen and the pharmacists take care of everything else. The nurses give the chemo. Therefore, we really, it's not the main part of what we do taking care of these patients. It is those, whether 5 or 10 or 15 minutes you spend with these patients before they go to the chemo room, that is so important. And these patients attach importance to every word we tell them. And you become so grounded as a human being because you need to be consistent. You need to know that they are the patient. Sometimes these patients need to tell us, I can tell you're not having a good day. What's going on? I mean, honestly, it's like, are you kidding me? I mean, you are the person with cancer and you are taking, and they tell me, no, we really want to know, are you taking care of yourself? I had a lot of people telling me that. Are you taking care of yourself? It's like, okay, yes. When are you taking vacation? I mean, I never thought a patient would ask me that with cancer.
Fascinating. Let's go and talk about your next patient, the 49-year-old lady.
Yeah, this is actually a patient, since I gave you the write-up, I updated a few things. This is really an amazing, amazing lady. This is a patient who, in her late 30s, she was diagnosed as having a very small triple-negative breast cancer, like 8 millimeter. And the reason why she was having mammograms in her 30s is because her sister was diagnosed with breast cancer in her mid-30s. And the patient started having mammograms when she turned 30. The sister is known to have a BRCA1 germline deleterious mutation. But the patient herself was not tested. She chose not to be tested. But she agreed to have mammograms early. In the late 30s, she was diagnosed with triple negative breast cancer, 8 millimeter. No big deal. She had lumpectomy. I gave her 4 cycles of docetaxel and cyclophosphamide, and she did very well. She said, in 5 years, I'm going to have my prophylactic oophorectomy. She was trying to plan her life and her family. And 5 years later, she scheduled total abdominal hysterectomy and bilateral salpingo oophorectomy. Before that, we actually tested her, and she turned out to be a BRCA2 mutation. And that was really shocking to me because her sister was a BRCA1. And both germline deleterious mutations. Looking into the history of the family, I have never seen that. Maybe our faculty member can comment on it. We discovered that this family, they have both a BRCA1 mutation and BRCA2. A BRCA1 from the mother, a BRCA2 from the father.
Wow.
I know, exactly. This patient ended up having prophylactic total abdominal hysterectomy, bilateral salpingo oophorectomy, and she was found to have stage 2A or 2B ovarian cancer. Just completely asymptomatic.
Wow.
It's really amazing. I got to know this family also very well because of their background, other diseases diagnosed at the same time in that family. But we treated her. She was really typical. She took the adjuvant treatment. She did very well. Very strong woman. Very supportive husband. Although she had children, I actually never met her children, but her husband was always with her. And she received 3 lines of treatment, including, as I said, carboplatin, paclitaxel, liposomal pegylated doxorubicin, and carboplatin gemcitabine. And after that, we put her on olaparib.
Could I just ask you before you go on to that, I see she also, I don't know, maybe this is incorrect because you said you changed it, but if it is, you can comment on it. I see she also got nab-paclitaxel and bevacizumab. We found a number of patients got NAB with ovarian cancer that kind of, I was sort of, wasn't on my radar. Do you use NAB in ovarian cancer?
This is a great point. Yes. I think from my own personal experience, and I mean, I see ovarian cancer patients, not like somebody who sees them entirely just ovarian. I have the impression in the last 5-7 years since started using nab-paclitaxel as if it's more effective than the taxanes. It's a gut feeling. I don't have data. And it's so much well tolerated with bevacizumab. And especially in patients who have ascites. I don't know. I've had really very good experience using bevacizumab, nab-paclitaxel, ovarian cancer, CERAS, not necessarily BRCA, with ascites. Who would really respond to this combination? I would like to hear more about this.
So as you mentioned, when she got to her sixth line of therapy, she's BRCA2 positive. And I don't know where this was in terms of the approval of olaparib, but she got olaparib.
Yes.
What was her condition when you started it? Was it already approved at that point?
No, she actually went on a study.
Oh, really? Huh.
She went on a study for olaparib. She received the 400 milligram PO twice a day, and she tolerated that well. Around week 5-6, Neil, she had a little bit of anemia. I think her hemoglobin went down to the low nines with some dyspepsia and heartburn, very little diarrhea. We lowered it only by one capsule of 50 milligram. Therefore, she will take, instead of 400 BID, she took 400 and 350. She kept on having the same side effects. We ended up lowering it down to 300 BID, which she did very well on this combination.
And did the tumor respond?
She responded very well.
Interesting. Yes. Incidentally, I noticed that you put under tolerability, very tolerable, no dose modifications necessary. It sounds like that wasn't the case.
Yeah, the anemia, although the patient tried, I think patients on the studies, Neil, they downplay the side effects really because they don't want you to take them off the trial. But when you really dig in, I tell my patients on the clinical trials, it's like, you know what, you need to tell us about the side effects because if we manage them, we will be able to keep you on the study. That's why, you know, the patient never really felt very, very sick because anemia is asymptomatic. But we tried to lower it a little bit, yes.
So it looks like she got the olaparib for 9 months, then had disease progression, got some more chemotherapy, ended up in hospice, and then passed away. Anything about this case you'd like to sort of run by Dr. Beerer?
Yeah, I mean, this is a lady that when she started progressing on olaparib, I mean, it wasn't really major progression, but it qualified as a progression to take her off the study. I mean, I want to ask, in somebody like this who is not on a study, and they have the BRCA germline mutation, and they have asymptomatic progression, would you keep olaparib and add something else, whether it is chemotherapy or anti-angiogenesis drugs? Do we have safety efficacy data using PARP inhibitors with something else? Because the clone that is BRCA positive is still there. And like we do with other cancers, like we keep, you know, trastuzumab, we keep other biological, we just change the background of chemotherapy. Because I'm treating a patient now, she's not on a study, and she's in exact that situation. She is progressing asymptomatically on olaparib, tolerating well for around 11 months. And I'm really tempted to add something else. I don't know if the insurance will pay for it, but I would like to know about the safety and efficacy, if he has any.
Yeah, that's a really great question. I mean, maybe a platinum agent. I don't know.
Actually, platinum, you know, alkylating agents, because then you pluck the DNA.
Right.
You're absolutely right.
Right. Any comments about taking care of her? Again, I see you checked off very attached, very satisfying to take care of her. Can you talk a little bit about her as a person and what it was like to take care of her?
She, amazing, amazing lady, very active in the community, in the school board, very smart and very content with life. Again, she lived really a very, very full life. Let me tell you another thing. While taking care of her, she actually brought me a relative of hers who had some pancytopenia for a few years, like mild pancytopenia. She said, if it's okay for you to see, it's like a second cousin. I said, yeah, of course. But this guy comes in mid-40s and asymptomatic, really, nothing. And his counts were low, definitely pancytopenia. And definitely the physical exam had really very large spleen. No adenopathy. So I said, oh my gosh, you know, pancytopenia and large spleen. We are going to talk about hairy cell leukemia, some myeloproliferative disorder. And we immediately did a bone marrow on the person, and the hematopathologist calls me like the next day in the morning. I have a definitive diagnosis. And guess what he turned out to have? Gaucher disease.
Wow.
It has never been described in the family. But going back in the history of the family, a couple of young people in the family were diagnosed as having Parkinson's disease with some stuff in the MRI of the brains.
Wow.
And I wonder, did those people actually have a glycogen storage disease abnormalities with the glycogen deposition in the brain and they were misdiagnosed as Parkinson's disease? I don't really know the answer to this question, but the patient was not loved having this diagnosis in the family. Actually, the family, instead, I thought they will tell her, thank you so much for, you know, now we can be screened. They actually ostracized her. They said, you are bringing on another disease to the family.
Wow.
Here, let me repeat this. They told her, you are bringing on another disease to the family.
Wow.
It's like, really?
Wow.
And that bothered her a lot. And since then, she had some good relation with her family members. But it's amazing. I don't know if our faculty has had something like that in his experience.
So let's go on and talk about your 68-year-old lady.
This is a 68-year-old woman whom I saw in 2012 after she had debulking surgery for a stage 3C ovarian cancer when she presented with vague abdominal symptoms, and actually she had ascites. When you go back in the history, it's amazing. She had symptoms for more than a year, and they were persistent symptoms. I saw her. She recovered from the surgery well. I discussed with her chemotherapy. She chose to take the intravenous carboplatin paclitaxel. This lady actually took, if I remember correctly, 8 cycles because her CA-125 became normal after cycle 5. And then I usually give like a couple of cycles more. And she did very well. She went into complete remission, but unfortunately, she recurred and she received the other chemotherapy agents after that. I think including bevacizumab and pegylated liposomal doxorubicin.
Before you go on, I meant to ask you about this before, but I was kind of surprised when I saw the responses. When you give post-surgical chemotherapy in ovarian cancer, in what fraction of the cases do you have no evidence of disease at the time you give the chemo? In other words, nothing measurable at normal CA.
Yeah, it definitely happens. I mean, nothing measurable because we don't actually do scans after surgery. I mean, the surgeon tells me it's optimally debulked. Therefore, we don't do PET scans. We don't do CAT scans. Therefore, there is nothing really we see. I mean, it depends. I would say that maybe 30%, 30 to 40% of patients, when they come to us after surgery, if you wait long enough, I mean, their CA-125 could be normal. But I would say 60%, the CA-125 is still very high, even after adequate waiting after surgery.
Okay, so that makes, you know, I know, I don't know, it maybe seems strange to you, but I guess I'm so far away from clinical that I didn't really realize it, because I kind of visualized post-debulking surgery as kind of adjuvant treatment. And that's why when we got back, you remember we had the problem with we weren't sure what people were sending. And a lot of people, it looked like they were giving what I would call adjuvant therapy, but then they would check off complete response. But what actually happened is most likely was their CA was up and it went back to normal.
To the normal range, at least on 2 occasions.
So it's really not exactly adjuvant.
It really is not. You are absolutely right. I mean, when there is CA-125 very high, there is really disease. And then, you know, the other thing, Neil, here is, you know, the normal range is very big range from like 0 to 30 or 35. And some of these women become so attached to their CA-125. I mean, is 25 as good as 15 or 5? I mean, we tell them yes, but only time will tell you if there is a trend of increase. But these patients, when their CA-125 increases from 5 to 10, they think it doubled. And it's really hard to explain it to them.
So another thing I was curious about, it came up with your first patient, and I forgot to ask you, and actually it sort of was relevant to this case too, relevant to all these cases, which is the issue of upfront treatment, IV versus IP. Is there anything you'd like to hear Dr. Beer address about not only that, but also the use of bevacizumab up front? Anything you'd want to ask him?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I would like to ask Dr. Piero about this. At one point, when Dr. Armstrong published her landmark paper in the New England Journal of Medicine, I mean, we looked at it, the data was really amazing. And actually, in my hospital, we set a way of really giving this therapy. And we actually became very good at it. We had specific nurses, we had our oncology floor, because, I mean, there was improvement in both progression-free survival and overall survival. You know, it was tough, but we got it down to doing it very well. These patients will be hydrated very well. They will come to the outpatient and take antiemetics anytime they want. And all of a sudden, and I really don't know why, like a couple of years later, we started going back because some data came that it may not be as effective. And we started going back to the intravenous without intraperitoneal, that actually I don't remember the last time I or my team used intraperitoneal. Therefore, I would like to know, how do we choose those who should take intraperitoneal versus just intravenous? Because that will be really very, very helpful. Obviously, patients who had a lot of bowel resection, we will not give them intraperitoneal. But are there, like, especially genomic marker about their cancer that will make us use intraperitoneal versus intravenous? Yes.
So another question I meant to ask you about the last case, which is anything you want to ask him about PARP inhibitors in general?
Yeah. You know, PARP inhibitors, like we know from, you know, I see breast cancer patients and we all know what happened with the excitement about PARP inhibitors. We know they are not all created equal. We have olaparib. It's the only one approved now. I mean, we just saw the data with ESMO about maintenance PARP inhibitor. So my question will be, what is the most effective PARP inhibitor we have in development? And is there a role for PARP inhibitors in patients who are BRCA positive upfront as maintenance? I wanted to ask him also about the role of bevacizumab upfront. Again, I really believe bevacizumab helps some patients with ovarian cancer. I don't know who are the patients and if there is any marker that we can enrich the group who will benefit the most.
Getting back to this lady, again, anything you want to say about taking care of her and what she was like as a person?
Yeah. Again, you know, I keep on saying amazing because honestly, all our patients are amazing. She gave a lot. This is a lady, actually, she was very active in her church. I think she went a couple of times down to Latin America to volunteer with her church group. And it happens that one of our nurses, this is really, she belonged to the same church she belonged to. But they became really very good friends and started traveling together and volunteering. Amazing, amazing. These people, a patient like hers, Neil, feels that she benefited so much from others coming ahead of her with these treatments and all these people helping her, that they feel the obligation to give. Because I think it's so fulfilling to them. It's like a healing experience. It was like a healing experience for her to go to another country and help for 10 days. You know, this is a patient on chemotherapy and has fatigue, but she did it, and she did amazingly well.
Why don't we go on and talk about your next patient, a 55-year-old lady.
Yes, this is a wonderful woman, 55-year-old. When I saw her a few years ago, the same typical presentation of ovarian cancer sent to us by our GYN surgical oncologist. We have a very active GYN surgical oncologist group. Therefore, we see a lot of these patients. She came, she recovered from the surgery very well. And this lady, actually, at the beginning, she was not sure she wanted to take chemotherapy, adjuvant chemotherapy. It took me 2 to 3 visits to show her data and the benefit from adjuvant therapy. Finally, she took adjuvant paclitaxel and carboplatin. She did very well, really. She did some peripheral neuropathy grade 1. She had some weird cough, I remember, that it wasn't really hypersensitivity to paclitaxel at all, wasn't really responsive to anything. We just gave her some hydrocodone and it will go away. She took the treatment. The amazing thing about this lady, during this treatment, Neil, she was taking care of her mother.
Wow.
Who was diagnosed with metastatic breast cancer to the bone. But she was dealing with her mother dying from breast cancer. And she was dealing with her own morbidity and, unfortunately, mortality. She had a daughter who was really very helpful. Unfortunately, her mother died shortly after she finished adjuvant therapy. The patient decided to relocate to the Northeast to be with her son, who lived in upstate New York, actually. But she didn't like it there, and then she came back. She did well for a while, then she recurred, unfortunately, with very aggressive disease. She took multiple lines of therapy, including, you know, bevacizumab and including carboplatin and gemcitabine.
Any questions you have about her case that you want to bring up? I guess one of the things I thought was interesting was that she had endometrioid cancer. I don't know exactly what the significance is. You tell me.
Yes, she did. She had endometrioid. My question will be, is there a preference for certain chemotherapeutic agents or anti-angiogenesis for this subgroup of patients with this histology? You know, I didn't feel this patient really responded very, very well. Honestly, I attributed it to she was never really positive in a lot of things we did, Neil. She took the treatment, but she will come. And I know she was going through a difficult time, of course, because of her mother. But, you know, talk about positive attitude. Maybe this is something we can, Dr. Perrault can discuss. You know, I have seen patients with the same disease, the same stage, the same treatment, the same doctor, the same nurses, and I can leave the room of one, and I tell my staff, she's not going to do well, and then I go see the other patient and leave the room, and I tell them, she's going to do great.
Wow.
And based on no real objective data. And honestly and truly, it is more likely that my prediction is correct than not.
Do you think that's their pre-morbid personality that you're reading? Or do you think maybe it's just something you're sensing about how sick they are?
Pre-morbid personality. Wow, good term. You know, maybe. Honestly, I never thought about it this way.
I mean, you think they were that way their whole life?
Yes, yes, exactly. I believe 100%. I really don't think cancer changes people a lot. Those who are nice, they are going to be nice even if they die tomorrow. And those who are not nice, they are not nice. Now, let me put a disclaimer here. There are a lot of not nice people who actually do very, very well. And it's amazing. And you know, I'm very verbal with these patients, actually. I give them stories how they can be positive. And we have very good psychologists and psychiatrists. We try to not change who they are, but change how they react to things. And I mean, I talk to them bluntly. It's like, what is wrong with you? It's like, you are doing well. You are in remission. You know, you want me to tell you about my 22-year-old whom I just saw from brain tumor? I mean, I don't like to compare people to each other, but I'm trying to put a point. And actually, sometimes you can have an impact. You really can have an impact. Because when we treat cancer, Neil, we're not trying to make people live longer. I mean, these patients, once they recur, they really are incurable. We want them to live life because my job is not to give chemo and have somebody live 2 years. My job is to help people have goals. Like you are asking me, you know, what are the goals? There are goals, and we set goals. Maybe not the first visit or the second visit. Maybe not the first line of treatment. But after the first line, you start knowing a lot of them about these patients because you want them to set goals. And that's really an important part of our job. Our nurses are very, very good in that. If I'm treating somebody, Neil, and every 3 weeks, you know, they are unhappy. I mean, I feel I'm not doing my job. I really do. I need to know that I'm doing it for a good reason and not just, you know, giving chemotherapy to people. Because many of them have some side effects. And many of them, you adjust the dose and you have to convince yourself it's worth it. It has nothing to do with cost. Now, that's another, you know, thing that we need to decide and discuss on a society basis. But it's like, I tell them, are you living? Oh, I don't know. What are you doing? Then why are you taking chemo? It's like, what do you mean, why am I taking chemo? I said, yeah, why are you taking chemo? Because you give it to me. I said, no. Let's go back. Let's go back to the drawing board. And, you know, every now and then we go over this. And it really helps them actually verbalize goals. And it really works in a lot of people. And it's, like you said, mindful meditation. You make people go back into their brains and think about it. For themselves, by the way, it has nothing to do with their daughter or getting married or anniversary, because I really believe if that person don't have a good grip on why they are doing it, they cannot really translate that into their spouse or their children. I don't know if I'm making myself clear here, but you need to know why you are doing this so that you can enjoy the fruits of your work. Because let me tell you, these people go through a tough time taking chemotherapy.
Yeah, you know, when you were talking about that, it made me think about the studies that have been done of the early use of palliative care that seemed to show a survival advantage. And, you know, people were like, well, why did it show a survival advantage? They started getting palliative care. They weren't even symptomatic at that point. So it was more, you know, talking to people. And talking to some of the people that have been involved with that research, I started to think that maybe the reason those people were living, you know, it was just a few months longer, but was maybe they wanted to. Maybe they got the support, the kind of support you're talking about, that got them more motivated to get through chemo.
Oh, no question in my mind. I am absolutely not surprised at the results of that study from Mass General published in the New England. On the contrary, I mean, I'm glad to see the data to prove it. I have no doubt in my mind that is so important to us. We in the oncology community, and I know most of my colleagues share this with me, the easiest part of our job is giving chemo. I mean, seriously, and I really mean it. I mean, it's very easy. You know, carboplatin, paclitaxel, but it's how you get people to not just tolerate it physically. We are also becoming very good at that. But how you live despite cancer, how you live with it as a disease now. You know, it's not chronic like hypertension, diabetes, because people can live decades, but sort of mini chronic disease that they are not going to die tomorrow or next month. And this is for them to increase their chances of responding by working with us, having this different attitude. And it helps them, you know, help them sleep better, not be in pain, take trips. I almost always tell people, okay, you have 10 cycles of chemo. We are going to give 5. After 5, what are you going to do? It's like, what? I'm going to receive cycle 6. I said, no. No. Yes, I know there is cycle 6, but is there something you want to do that I can give you a week or two? Yeah, sure, it's not complete drug holiday, but you know, it's palliative chemotherapy. I wouldn't give it after cycle 1, but at one point, you need to have these people start planning things. And it's amazing how much these patients will come back to you. Oh my God, I talked to my family and we're going to go on this cruise and we're going to do this. And it can be something, you know, just something simple, going to the beach. Then they come back so energized with positive outlook that number 6 to through number 10 will work better even.
You know, we were trying to sort of roughly paint a portrait of what happens to people in these situations. And you've described a lot of it in terms of the therapies that are given, you know, some of the psychosocial issues that are occurring at the same time, goals, et cetera. But there's another thing that we found that sort of layers in there in terms of this overall picture, which is that out of these 233 people who all had common cancers that we know when they're metastatic are not currently curable, of these 233 people, 15 entered clinical trials, and less than half were clinical trials even brought up as a possibility. And, you know, our take on this is that it's not because the patients don't want to go on trials. It's not that the docs don't want to put patients on trials, but the system, the infrastructure that a doc deals with just doesn't provide that opportunity. Any thoughts about that?
Yeah, this is absolutely. And I looked at some of this data from your project, Neil, and that definitely struck me as a major issue, especially in the ovarian cancer. I felt even from my own experience, I'm very involved in clinical research. We have a very big organization. We put around 13-14% of our patients on clinical trials. Not good enough, but better than the national averages. But I was really surprised that I have not being able to put many patients ovarian cancer on trials. I think it is because of the difficult infrastructure, no question about it. It has become so much easier than before, than a decade or two ago. But for some diseases, it is really harder. It's so much easier now to put patients with lung cancer on studies. We have a lot of studies. I mean, breast has always been very good. But in ovarian, this is another, Dr. Perur maybe can discuss the percentage of patients who go on the clinical trials with ovarian cancer. Why is it so low? I mean, I have another part-time job sort of surveying cancer programs in this country for the American College of Surgeons. And it's amazing the lack of number of patients put on the clinical trials. Again, much better than before, but it's not much more than the 6% we mandate people to put on to get accreditation. I think we really need to work on a system that is smoother to enroll patients on the clinical trials.
So let's, I think you have one more case here, the 52-year-old lady. Maybe you can go through her.
This is a 52-year-old woman I saw a while ago, and she was diagnosed with stage 3C ovarian cancer. She tolerated treatment very well in the adjuvant setting, optimal debulking adjuvant with intraperitoneal chemotherapy. She had a little bit tough time, I remember, with some nausea and a slight bump in the creatinine from the intraperitoneal cisplatin, but she did very well. She took all the 6 cycles. She did well for a couple of years. Then she recurred, and she had multiple lines of treatment. She was BRCA negative, and she took bevacizumab and liposomal doxorubicin, and she did really well on the treatment for, I think she lived several years from the diagnosis. I think she lived around 7 years. The interesting thing about this patient that I remember very well is she actually was married, and she had a granddaughter. It's not really a granddaughter. It's like a step-granddaughter. It's a granddaughter of her husband. And she was very, very excited when her granddaughter, in the midst of her treatment, was admitted to medical school. I remember it was an unbelievable celebration. She brought us pictures and a video. But I remember that very, very well. She was very, very proud of that.
Any questions you have about her case or anything else you want to relate about it? Or any other questions you have about ovarian cancer in general that you'd like to address to Dr. Beer?
Yeah, I have actually quite a few of them, Neil. One, we didn't discuss how often we order next-generation sequencing on these patients. Actually, at one point, beyond first line, I will send next-generation sequencing on all these patients. But I was so disappointed by how few of actionable targets we would find in these patients. And even when we found one, we either didn't have an approved drug or there is no trial. But I would like to ask, where are we with this genomic subclassification of ovarian cancer? We all know it's not one disease. It's absolutely not one disease. Yes, we go with histology, serous, endometrioid, but that's like the times when we divided lymphomas into Hodgkin and non-Hodgkin. Where are we with genomic testing in ovarian cancer? Where are we with next-generation sequencing? What is very promising next target on ovarian cancer? I mean, we know about PARP, we know about homologous recombination, repair. The other thing I want to ask is bevacizumab. We really need to do more work about this drug. Who will benefit from it? Who will benefit from it the most? There is really no good screening test for ovarian. Is there any data or test on the horizon? And where are we with the monoclonal antibodies? The folate receptor, I mean, I used to hear a lot about it and some promising. Where is the antibody drug conjugates and monoclonal antibodies on ovarian cancer?
And, you know, we just saw the data came out in Europe at the ESMO meeting on niraparib used in the maintenance setting, platinum-sensitive maintenance after chemotherapy, showing a benefit not only in BRCA germline, not only in HRD positive, but in HRD negative, BRCA negative. Any questions you have for Dr. Beer about that data and what it might mean to practice?
Yeah, I mean, what is the mechanism of action of this drug in those other patients without the BRCA and the other markers that we associate with PARP inhibitors? Neil, I think ovarian cancer is an ideal disease for maintenance treatment. Why am I saying that? This is the disease even in suboptimally debulked patient. We still have disease. We still have more than 10 to the 12 cells like we see with hematologic malignancies. Even more than that, and in hematologic malignancies, we cannot cure them without some radical treatment. More than half of these patients with ovarian cancer treated in the adjuvant, they recur. I would say 50 to 60%, depending on the type of surgery. But, you know, maintenance treatment, and I know we tried paclitaxel, it didn't work very well. We tried with pazopanib, I don't think it's ideal. I don't know if bevacizumab works. But where are we with some vaccine trials, PARP inhibitors in the maintenance of this disease? And why did this drug work so well with a hazard ratio of 0.5? I don't think we've ever seen it in ovarian cancer literature.
Yeah, particularly with the germline negative.
Yeah.
This concludes our program. For information on lung and colorectal cancer, please turn to the other two CDs on this program. Special thanks to our faculty, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for this special program utilizing the Morbidity Mortality Conference model to explore and improve community-based cancer care.